Thank you very much. I first joined the congressional staff in the summer of 1974, the International Economic Subcommittee of the Joint Economic Committee, and returned in the early summer of 1975 to the House Banking Committee, of which Henry Royce had become chair, and shortly after Congress had passed House Concurrent Resolution 133, which obliged the chair of the Federal Reserve for the first time to appear on a regular schedule before the banking committees and to report on the conduct of monetary policy. In 1976, I was in the group, which included Leon Kaiserling, the first chair of the Council of Economic Advisers under President Truman, that met with Representative Augustus F. Hawkins to draft H.R. 50, the Hawkins-Royce predecessor to the Humphrey-Hawkins Act. No one else was much interested in monetary policy, so I drafted Section 108 of that bill, of the law, basically in line with the reporting requirements already in place. The effect was to place the Federal Reserve unambiguously under what is now called the dual mandate, as it later became known, but specifically under the goal of full employment, something that had not been the case before. Over time, the Humphrey-Hawkins hearings have worked to transform the Federal Reserve into a public-facing institution. We began this process in June 1975, the first of these hearings, by asking a very reluctant, secretive, and imperious Arthur Burns to provide the Fed's staff economic forecast, a totally innocuous request, which he declined to meet. But successive members of Congress continued to ask that question until the early afternoon. He finally tired and provided what he called his personal view. And the next question, of course, was, Mr. Chairman, is your personal view consistent or inconsistent with the view of the Federal Reserve staff? And at that point, the cat was out of the bag and it never went back in. In 1978, the Humphrey-Hawkins Act became law. And in the summer of 1979, Paul Volcker took over at the Federal Reserve. There followed his supposed conversion to monetarism and a very glaring conflict between the full employment mandate and actual policy, which crushed manufacturing and drove unemployment past 10% with interest rates that breached 20% for months. Yet Volcker also accelerated the transition toward openness. The hearings became a stage set largely by Chairman Royce, who would send a detailed interrogatory letter well in advance, about 6 weeks in advance of the hearings, prompting careful preparation by Fed staff of their chair in anticipation of questions that he knew we'd receive. I drafted those letters and retained copies of the hearing records. The details of the colloquies are not all that important in the long run, but they established the right of Congress to ask specific and detailed questions and to expect a well-prepared answer. And Chairman Volcker, very much to his credit, cooperated with this process. The policy conflict was nevertheless intense. And this brings me to the second point I want to make, which this conflict came to a head in the catastrophic recession of 1981-82, the immediate cause of the beginning of major deindustrialization of the United States, which is the long-term cause of the rise of China and, frankly, also of Donald Trump. By that time, I was at the Joint Economic Committee as executive director. From there, we attempted to test the power of Congress to pressure the Federal Reserve directly on interest rates. Recognizing that there was no single best way to do this, in fact, no truly good way to phrase a resolution, I drafted competing versions, one of them for Jim Wright, majority leader in the House, and the other one for Robert Byrd, minority leader in the Senate. One calling for lower long-term interest rates, and the other for lower real interest rates, whatever that might mean. The stratagem was intended and succeeded in creating a degree of confusion, which eventually brought the staff liaison of the Federal Reserve, Don Wynn, to my office. I don't think he was aware that I was behind all of this, asking me what might bring the take off the pressure. And I said, well, you know, Don, if the interest rates start to fall, the air will probably go out of these balloons. And shortly afterwards, that's what happened. There was also a third resolution, which I had passed off to staff for Daniel Patrick Moynihan on the Budget Committee, calling for lower interest rates in response to budget restraint, which budget resolutions always pretend to have affected. I'd almost forgotten that one until a writer for the St. Louis Fed Journal resurrected it quite recently and gave it credit for having caused a certain amount of worry at the Federal Open Market Committee as the minutes of May 18th, 1982 confirmed that, in fact, it did. Congress, in short, does have the power to effectively pressure the Federal Reserve on interest rate policy in conditions where it feels it's appropriate to do so. Of course, all this was long ago, and almost all the direct participants have long passed away. It's an advantage to be one of the last survivors. And I drifted from direct engagement after the mid-1980s, but let me offer a few remarks on what seems to have happened in the intervening 40 years. In the Greenspan era, the Fed mastered the art of using the oversight process for its own purposes. The stage direction passed from the bench to the witness table, and as effectively, so effectively that when legislation lapsed, the Fed carried on with the hearings on its own initiative until the mandate was restored. At the same time, Greenspan was markedly free of academic orthodoxy, allowing interest rates and unemployment to fall, achieving the Humphrey Hawkins goals for the first time in the late 1990s. The means, however, involved sequential speculative booms, which ended in grief in 2000 and 2008, a pattern that is now well established. Ben Bernanke brought the ideas of a rather dreary period in academic macroeconomics to the job, a kind of monetarism without monetary control, centered on an inflation target justified initially by a nonsense construct called the Nehru, to be achieved by pronunciamiento and prestidigitation. Monetary policy is macro magic or as an act of faith. And I'm afraid Janet Yellen, I think, basically followed in the same tradition. But the economy evolved in such a way that the interest rate lost its capacity, its traction, which it had had under Volcker, and no longer carried the kind of weight on macroeconomic variables that the models presumed it would have. As Ray and Nersissian have pointed out, and I'll let Randy deal with this in more detail, the 2% target has no legal basis, no basis in economic analysis, and the Fed has no actual capacity to hit it, habitually falling below or running above. By nodding along with this notion, Congress has abandoned its basic responsibility, and by turning the inflation problem over to the Fed, previous administration basically sealed its own fate, bringing the present one to power. I do have considerable sympathy for Chairman Powell, who as a banker has no higher scientific pretensions, makes arguments opportunistically, and conducts policy in the press. As I have written, that policy follows the long-standing pattern. The Fed conducts monetary policy to pressure and discipline the American workforce. What was hidden in secrecy, a central bank that's essentially acting as the agent of bankers, and later in economic obscurantism, is now openly admitted. And the question is what to do about it. Of course, an openly political and distributive central bank invites political criticism, and in my view, one cannot fault this administration or parts of it from stating their view. But there is an obvious institutional difficulty in which to cede or to appear to cede to the White House would compromise the integrity of the central bank, and behind it, the authority of the Congress. So it puts the Federal Reserve in an extremely difficult position to have pressure coming from the administration, even if it were to agree privately that the pressure had some merit, it would have to be very cautious about following along without appearing to becoming the tool of the White House. And what does that leave? That leaves the United States Congress to do the actual job entrusted to it by the Constitution and embodied in the law that's been in effect now for half a century, but which gives tools which are frankly not being effectively deployed, but which could be deployed if the Congress were to choose, first of all, to work out for itself what it wanted to achieve with the oversight of monetary policy, and secondly, to entrust to its own appropriate officials, to its chairs and members, the responsibility to bring the Federal Reserve back under the laws as a creature of Congress it should be. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.